I'm Rob Naderhood, a senior here at Calvin College and Secretary of the Student Senate, and I would like to welcome you to the January Series 2002 of Calvin College. Let's pray. Our Father in Heaven, thank you for the opportunity you have given us today to come together to learn more about the universe you have created. We ask, Lord, that in the midst of the ever-expanding boundaries of science and technology, you may grant us the wisdom necessary to act in accordance with your will. In your name we pray, amen. And now Henry DeVries, Vice President for Administration, Finance, and Information Services, will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Rob, and good afternoon. Before I introduce our speaker, let me make two quick announcements. A reminder that on Monday, the January Series lecture with Charles Colson will be held in the Calvin College Fieldhouse. There will be shuttle parking available from both the Church of the Servant and from Emmanuel Reformed Church. After today's presentation, Mr. Rifkin will not be having a question and answer session. However, he will be available in the West Lobby for 20 minutes for book signing. So if you wish to speak with him then, you may. It's my particular pleasure to introduce Jeremy Rifkin today. I'm part of a faculty reading group this term, reading on the questions of agricultural biotechnology. Mr. Rifkin has recently written a very important work in that area. Never before in history has humanity been so unprepared for the new technological and economic opportunities, challenges, and risks that lie on the horizon. Our way of life is likely to be more fundamentally transformed in the next several decades than in the previous 1,000 years. So predicts Jeremy Rifkin in his best-selling book, The Biotech Century. Humanity is on the brink of wielding greater control over both the biology of life, how we are born, how our food supply is created, the traits our children may have, than has ever been imagined before. But within each step, we must ask ourselves, at what cost? Mr. Rifkin has spent time asking, rethinking, and in writing about that very question. He's the author of 15 books addressing the impact of scientific and technological changes on the economy, the workforce, society, and the environment. He has been influential in shaping public policy in the United States and around the world. He has testified before numerous congressional committees and has had consistent success in litigation to ensure responsible government policies on a variety of environmental, scientific, and technology-related issues. In terms of the new science and technology, the most important issue is to give it considerable public attention. So Mr. Rifkin is here today to help us do that. Calvin College is grateful to the Blue Cross Blue Shield of West Michigan for underwriting today's presentation. Please help me welcome Jeremy Rifkin.
Good afternoon, everybody. First, a little ground rule. No note taking. Put it away. Some of you, I know this is a genetically inherited characteristic. No doubt they'll find the gene soon. Do you take notes when you have a drink with a friend? You do? I think I'd like you to go up to the back row, because you're going to be a problem for me. When you're out with a friend, having a conversation, it can be an important conversation, you can probably relay every nuance of that conversation the next day, correct? So notes are a way of selectively forgetting. Trust me here. You're going to remember every single thing that was said this afternoon, if you want to. For the last 40 years, we've been tracking two emerging technology revolutions, computers and genes, the information sciences, the life sciences, software and wetware. In the last few years, these defining technologies of the 21st century have begun to fuse together to create a single paradigm for the opening of a new period of human history. The computer has many purposes in the 21st century. How many were at my lecture last year? And we talked, and you came back, thank you. And we talked about the role of the computer in creating a new network-based global economy. There's even a more fundamental role for the computer. It's the language to organize genes, to decipher genes, to download genes, to manage and exploit genes. And genes are the raw resource for the 21st century. We're making a great historic transition from the age of chemistry and physics, which dominated the Industrial Revolution, to the age of biology, which will dominate the genetic revolution. We're entering the biotech century. Computers and genes. To put this in perspective, let me use an analogy. For thousands of years, we've been using fire technologies. We're a Promethean creature. We've been burning and soldering and forging and melting and heating the inert materials from the crust of this planet, and we've transformed those materials into all sorts of utilities. Steel, glass, cement, synthetics, plastics. The apotheosis of the Promethean era, the era of fire technology, in my lifetime, we split the atom. And we unleashed the power of the sun. In the 1970s, two biologists at Stanford and the University of California, Boyer and Cohn, they did something in their laboratory that some say may be analogous in import to the fire revolution. They took slices of genetic material from two unrelated organisms and stitched them together. They recombined them, creating a new organism that had never before existed. The process is called recombinant DNA. But now, instead of fusing, soldering, forging, melting, and heating inert materials to create new utilities, we now talk about recombining and cloning and editing and splicing across biological boundaries to create new living things. Food, pharmaceuticals, medicine, energy, building materials, packaging. There's really nothing on this planet that cannot be transformed in biology to the utilities of life. However, when we deal with life, we're not dealing with inanimate material. It raises a whole slew of new questions that we're not prepared for. Over the last 25 years, as some of you know, I've been critical of some aspects of this biotech revolution, and many in the scientific community and the business community, the biotech community, have said, Mr. Rifkin, what's the problem here? We've been breeding nature since the dawn of the Neolithic agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago. We've been domesticating our fellow creatures, our animals, our plants. Isn't biotechnology just a more sophisticated way to get the job done? Let me respectfully disagree with the orthodox and conventional thinking. I'm going to give you four experiments here that no breeder in history could have ever done, from the great cereal cultures of 6,000 years ago to the agricultural extension college laboratories today. Four experiments to show you how qualitatively different this revolution is. At the University of Pennsylvania, several years ago, Harold Brinster led a team. They took a human growth hormone gene. That's a human gene. They took the gene, they placed it into the genetic code of mice embryo. The mice were born, and they were unlike any mice in history. They had a human growth hormone gene replicating in all the cells of the body. This particular strain of mice grew twice as big, and twice as fast to maturity than any mice in history. And on the cover of the journal Science, they had the famous photo, how many have seen it, with the regular mouse and the big mouse. That was an eye-opener. More importantly, each successive generation of those mice now pass that human gene on to their offspring. We can't do that in classical breeding. In classical breeding, we know that we can cross some biological boundaries. We know that viruses, for example, can act as vectors and hosts, and they'll pass genes on. But not at this level, at a multicellular level. I'm going to give you an example. Sheep and goats, totally unrelated species, correct? Anybody here from farms? But you know that no matter how lonely these two little animals may be in the barnyard, nothing's really going to happen here.
Scientists at Edinburgh, Scotland, for some reason, that's where they like to do these experiments. My wife and I have visited Edinburgh. We don't think there's anything particularly strange about that city, but who knows? There may be some karma lingering over Edinburgh from ancient times. But in Edinburgh, they took a sheep embryo and a goat embryo, unrelated species, and they fused them together and gave birth to the first new species in human history. It's called a geep. That's what it's called. It has the head of a goat and the body of a sheep. It's a chimera out of ancient Greek mythology. We cannot do that in classical breeding. In classical breeding, we can cross some boundaries because taxonomy is an anthropocentric exercise. God said to Adam and Eve, name the animals. So we said, that looks like a mule, that looks like a donkey, that looks like a horse. They're close enough within a family that you can breed them and give birth to a sterile mule. But in classical breeding, in all of these 10,000 years we've been experimenting with it, we cannot yet cross, in classical breeding, a donkey and an apple tree. Can't be done. My friends, with this technology, we can do that. We can reduce life to its genetic components and the proteins they code for, and then take any of those genes in theory and practice and place them over into an unrelated species and create new combinations and utilities and forms that have never existed pell-mell across the expanse of the biological kingdom. We can do it. We are doing it in laboratories around the world today. Thousands of laboratories. Third experiment. Scientists took the gene that codes for a protein that emits light, luminescence, in a firefly, placed it in the genetic code of a tobacco seed. The fully mature plant glows 24 hours a day. Luther Burbank couldn't do that. Smart man, but he couldn't do that. And now, of course, they've done it with a cat. One of the most outrageous exercises in what we call performance art, an artist in Chicago contracted with a French lab. They took that fluorescent gene and they gave birth to a cat that lights up. Why? He thought it would be an interesting performance art for people to see. Shameful. Shame on him. Final experiment. Dr. Wilmot Sheep, again at Edinburgh. Dr. Wilmot cloned the sheep. All of us were so concerned, our first question, being as narcissistic as we are, what about us? What about us? Let me just say now, if the first human being has not already been cloned, we don't know. It's imminent. You're going to open up the newspaper. It could be next month. It could be in a year. It could be in 2 or 3 years, and someone's going to do it. There are now 150 women who have been set up to bear a cloned baby already in Canada. It's in the process. But we all missed the big story here about cloning. All of us were concerned about the first sheep. What was the first sheep's name? Have you ever heard of the second sheep? Anybody know the second sheep's name? Polly. From the business point of view, I teach at the Wharton School, executive program, and I can tell you from the business point of view, Dolly wasn't important, Polly was. Here's what they did with Polly. Dr. Wilmot and his team took a human gene. They then took the gene and they put it into an adult sheep cell. Then they cloned the sheep. Here's what they demonstrated to the investment community. That it's now possible to customize by product line and then mass produce identical copies of a living original with the same quality controls and design principles that we put in place on the assembly line at the turn of the last century with petrochemical-based products. What are engineering principles? Any engineers here? Oh, I love being in liberal arts colleges. We all know about the world, but we don't know how to manage it. But that's something else. We can talk about that later. I couldn't resist. I love this school, so that's why I said that. All right. Engineering standards, quality controls, predictable outcomes, thermodynamic rates of efficiency, and pure utility. Those are engineering standards. We applied them effectively during the entire sojourn of the Industrial Revolution. Now the question at hand, my friends, do we want to apply those engineering standards directly into the blueprints of life? Customized, mass-produced, predictable outcomes. That's why the cloning of a human being and the cloning of an embryo, which is now right in front of public policy, is probably a seminal turning point and a singular event in world history. And we'll go into that in a few moments. But what I want to suggest by these four experiments is this is a different genre of human manipulation, something quite unique, the ability to cross all the biological boundaries and create new and interesting forms. We know there are going to be potential benefits. Feed the world, arrest all the serious diseases that have haunted humanity, provide a better way of life. But what are the risks? What are the risks of introducing cloned, chimeric, and transgenic animals en masse into the world? Why, might we see in your century the end of the natural world and the substitution of a bio-industrial second genesis? What are the consequences of allowing a handful of life science companies the ability to patent and own life as their own intellectual property? What will it mean for your generation when we begin to release thousands and then tens of thousands of genetically modified organisms to reseed the earth, the water, and the air with our own conception of what biology ought to be? And finally, what is the toll it takes on the human mind and the metaphysics of our existence when we can design our babies in advance of execution? On the agenda, right now. Let's take a look. By the way, before I go into this, do we have any biologists here? Let me say at the get-go, the issue here is not the science. For the last 20 years, we've been having an inappropriate debate. Are you for the future or are you against progress? So all the scientists and business leaders are for the future, and any of the critics or skeptics are Luddites and opposed to the postmodern world. That's pretty much how it works out. It works well for CNN Crossfire and 2-second sound bites on Fox News. But you know what? It's a primitive discussion. There's a better discussion. The issue here is not the science. It's how it's applied. We would never tell our young people, don't learn about genes in the laboratory when you go into biology class. That would be nonsense. We're learning valuable information about part of life. As long as we understand that the genes and the proteins they code for are not the whole story. The genes are not the recipe, they are just the ingredients. As long as we maintain the idea that genes are not the whole of our concept, it's all right to know about genes. They're part of a larger system of life. The issue here is how do we apply this great science that's unfolding in our real world? And what I'm going to suggest to you today, there's a hard path and a soft path. They're born of different sensibilities, different values, different first principles, and they lead to very different technological applications in goods and services, and each creates a different century for your generation. Right now, we're on the hard path, the path that's been set out by Monsanto and Eli Lilly and the pharmaceutical companies and life science companies. What I'm going to suggest later is that the soft path may be more in line with the values in this room. It may be more intellectually stimulating. It may be more scientifically progressive, and it may allow us to have a world, at least a legacy of a world, that could be a second renaissance. So I'm going to surprise you by saying I think that this biology could be a great step forward, but it'd have to be used in a totally different way. Let's look at the hard path first, the path we're on. First, the name of the game is genes. Whoever controls the genes controls the raw resource for the 21st century. As you know, the announcement was made last year that we have finally been able to map the overall genome. But that's just the beginning. Now the greatest commercial treasure hunt in history, locating all the individual genes for every species within that broad genomic map. The public knows we're looking for genes, but what the public doesn't know is that every time a gene is located and isolated, it's immediately claimed as an invention at the U.S. Patent Office. That means that in less than 10 years, virtually all 30 or 40,000 genes that make up the blueprints of our species will be owned and controlled in the form of intellectual property by a handful of companies, either directly or indirectly through license to academic institutions and other enterprises. The breast cancer gene, the cystic fibrosis gene, on and on. Imagine the power here. I work with businesses, Fortune 100 businesses all over the world, and other companies say to me, my God, That amount of power given over to one industry, the ability of a handful of companies to actually own the blueprints of life for our species, our fellow creatures, and so they can dictate the terms upon which we enter the age of biology, it's breathtaking in scope, that kind of power. What will it mean? Let me give you an example of how interesting this is. Dr. Willman, who cloned the sheep, would you like to know what his patent covers? We had two debates, one a couple years ago in Tennessee, and then one last year at the World Economic Forum, and I asked him in the first debate, he hadn't gotten his patent yet, I said, what does your patent application cover? I said, I know it covers the process of cloning, because that's your right. I know it also covers all animals. A cloned animal is considered your intellectual property. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I said, does your patent application cover anything else? I said, what about human embryos? He went ballistic, and he said, I don't know, I don't. That's ridiculous. Of course, he signed the application. He knew. It turns out I was right. The British Patent Office last year, and I want you to listen to this, they gave him a patent for the process of cloning. They gave him a patent for all cloned animals, meaning the products are his intellectual property, and they had one addenda. The British Patent Office became the first government in the world to grant Willman and his company a patent on all human embryos up to the blastocyst stage of development. That's the stage where you can harvest the pluripotent stem cells for stem cell research. Regardless of where you may sit in this room on the issue of right to life pro-choice, we all have different ideas, both sides, I would think, would be aghast at the idea that we can now own an individual life at the early stages of the development as an invention. In the last century, we had a great debate in this world as to whether you can own an individual as property after birth. And after thousands of years of holding each other as slaves, we finally abolished slavery in the 19th century. But now the technology is at hand to be able to own an individual human being from conception to birth as intellectual property. Certainly this ought to raise one of the great political debates of all of history. And yet, all we've heard is silence. How many even knew about this patent? It's astounding. But it's only the beginning. You see, there's a great north-south issue here. It turns out that most of the genes worth owning, as probably you know, are in the southern hemisphere in the equatorial belt. That's where the biodiversity of the planet is, all the remaining creatures we have not yet done away with. So, the northern biotech companies, they send genomic prospectors down into the Amazon to find rare genes in microbes, plants, animals, and indigenous human populations. They find a gene that might look commercially as a prospect for medicine or food, they patent it. The southern countries are crying biopiracy. These are our resources. You can't just come and take them. Of course, the life science companies are saying, we add value. We take these raw resources, we turn them into actual useful products, therefore we should be able to recoup our investments in the form of intellectual property. Who's right? How about neither one? I don't think that the gene pool, millions of years of evolution, I don't believe the gene pool is the intellectual property of Monsanto. I sure don't think it's the political property of Brazil. What do you think? The gene pool is a priori to any institution we've created in the modern era, where it's political or academic or commercial. If we allow the gene pool to become the political property of governments or the intellectual property of companies, I guarantee you, you young people here, your children will have gene wars in the 21st century. It's the raw resource for the next era in history. We fought wars over metals and minerals during the mercantilist era. A lot of young people died. We fought wars over oil in the industrial era, and a lot of young people died. We send our young out to die for these basic resources. And if the gene pool becomes political property or intellectual property, is anyone here naive enough to think we won't have conflicts over genes? It's the basics of all of life. The cost element's interesting here. If you go in to take a genetic screening test today, there's about 900 genes you can be screened for. The test costs about $50. You know how much a genetic screening test costs for a patented gene, like the breast cancer gene? It can be $2,000, even $2,500. Now, do the math. In a few years from now, I know I'd like to, and my family would like to be screened for a number of genes that might be in our family history to see about developing a preventive medicine regime for ourselves. We walk into the doctor's office, say, I'd like to be screened for the following 50 genes, $2,000 a hit. What do you think the HMO's response is going to be? But then they refuse. They didn't screen. Someone becomes ill, and it could have been prevented had they screened. Then what are you going to find? Litigation. We're going to either break the healthcare system through litigation or the high cost of the screening. Even beyond the commercial applications, the real question here is a philosophical question. Will our children be well served, our children, your children, if they grow up in a world where they think of all of life as intellectual property? The genes, the proteins they code for, the cells, the tissues, the organs, the organisms, the species. You know, we teach our children when they're very young, around 2.5, we introduce them to the intrinsic value of life. It may be the family dog, the family cat, their siblings. We say life is valuable, life is unique, life has intrinsic value, you have to respect it. When your children are a little bit older, you introduce them to utility. The fact is, we do live on a planet where we occasionally expropriate other forms of life to secure our own, but always with respect. But you would never, parents, you would never start with your kid by introducing the family dog as utility. Do what you'd like with it, correct? You'd create a monster. So imagine the psychological morbidity here. What will happen if successive generations grow up in a world where they think that all of life at every level is simply an invention, intellectual property, something to be patented, chemicals to manipulate? What happens to the intrinsic value when our children's frame of reference is it's all utility? Interesting enough, this is an issue that crosses all the political divides. We'll talk about this later, but in 1995, we put together a coalition of religious leaders to oppose the patents on animal and human genes. It was the largest coalition of religious leaders in U.S. history. It included Richard Lamb, the Southern Baptist Convention, and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, but it also included the heads of the Reformed Judaism, Reconstructionist Judaism. It included 250 Catholic bishops and the Presbyterians and the Methodists, and my old friend Wes Granberg Michelson up here at the Reformed Church of America. Everybody came together once. And when Richard Lamb was out from the Southern Baptist Convention, sat up there at the press conference with the head of the Reformed Jews, they never agree on anything politically, they said, this time we do, because either the genes are God's creation or they're a human invention. It can't be both. If it's a human invention, theology's over. If we're about to say that life itself is our creation and we're going to imprint it in law and emboss it in commercial life, what role is there for theology and faith in the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd century? What happens when your grandchildren don't even have a frame of reference to think the way you do about faith? We need to cast a great treaty. Later this month in Porto Alegre, Brazil, 50,000 NGOs from around the world are assembling, and we have put together a treaty to make the gene pool by a commons, like we did with Antarctica. We're going to announce it there in Brazil. You know, with Antarctica, we took the last continent and we said no one owns it. It's a legacy. It's a responsibility. It's a collective stewardship mission. Should we do any less with the gene pool? It's our biggest legacy. It's our most important responsibility. It's our obligations to steward it for future generations. Why not establish it as a commons, signed by every country in the world, so we take responsibility for this for future generations? I have no problems with companies having process patents or licenses because they need to recoup their investment. But if we allow them to control the actual blueprints of life, we will rule the day in the 22nd century. Just because it can be done doesn't mean it will be done. I will predict to you that patents will fail. Even though the momentum's there, we will defeat, this generation will defeat patents because it doesn't square with the values and sensibilities that you share in this room. And you're no different than people all over the world. No patents on life. You're going to hear a new term in the next few years, genetic pollution. Genetic pollution is different than chemical pollution because genetic pollution, we're dealing with organisms. They're alive. They reproduce. They mutate. They migrate. They proliferate. You can't recall them to the laboratory. So we have to apply a different standard. Now, right now, there are 72,000 field tests going on with genetically modified organisms. 72,000 field tests in the U.S. alone. That's the extent of this. And as you know, we've begun to introduce genetically engineered crops into our fields. Over half of the fields in the last 4 years are now planted with genetically engineered corn and soy and canola. What are the problems here? When you take a gene from a flounder fish, a gene that makes it resistant to frost, and you place that into the genetic code of a tomato so the mature tomato is resistant to frost, that's different than classical breeding. You're really crossing the boundaries. Is it going to be safe? Probably. Can we guarantee it or even reasonably think so? Maybe not. It's the scale here. Imagine introducing thousands and thousands of genetically modified microorganisms, insects, fish, marine life, plants, and reseeding this earth in a short time period of evolutionary history, less than 25 years. If only a small percentage of these GMOs, genetically modified organisms, turn out to be a pest, we've got a problem for generations, centuries, and millennia to come. It is a second genesis. I'll give you an example before I go to the food crops. There's a second generation of biotech GMOs being readied. These are what we call value enhancement crops. These are crops where they place a gene into the crop so that the crop produces a pharmaceutical product or a drug or a biodegradable plastic that you can harvest. Now, who would be opposed to that? But what they've never stopped to consider, when you seed millions of acres of land with a second generation of crop and the plants are producing genes with proteins that code to make pharmaceuticals and chemicals and biodegradable plastics, what happens to foraging birds and insects and microorganisms and other animals that come in contact with it? Not one hearing in one parliament in the world about this. You don't have to be a molecular biologist to understand that's fraught with problems. The crops that are out there now are pest-resistant and herbicide-tolerant. You're eating them in foods, but you don't know because unlike Europe, which is labeling, we're not labeling. Why aren't they labeling? How many of you would eat the foods if you saw the label? None of you. So our industry is, they're so cowardly, if they really had confidence in their products, they'd label them. Europe not only is labeling them, they're not allowing most of it in, nor is Japan and many other parts of the world. We are. Herbicide-tolerant product, crops. They take, Monsanto takes a gene, codes it into the corn or soy so it's resistant or hurt to the herbicide. So you can use a lot of herbicides by Monsanto. You buy the herbicide and you buy the patented gene seed. So it's a package. Kind of interesting from a marketing perspective. You have to buy it as a package. Brilliant. You can then spray herbicides, right? And kill your weeds, but you won't kill your plant because it has a gene that's herbicide tolerant. You with me here? What's the problem here? The benefit is also the long-term entropy problem. You can't kill all the weeds. So in the short run, you're going to kill some weeds. You won't kill your plant, but you can't kill all the weeds. The super-resistant strains then dominate. And then your herbicide tolerance is no longer effective. Then you can continually have to find new herbicide-tolerant genes each year. How can you possibly catch up? Second law of thermodynamics, you never break even, you always lose. The question is, when do you pay the bill? Every island of order, you create a sea of disorder. We should ask our molecular biologists to confer with the engineers about the laws of thermodynamics so they better understand non-equilibrium living systems and how they really function. Same with the pesticide resistance. They're talking about taking a gene, they're doing it in all the fields now, that's coded so that every cell of the plant produces a toxin. So the little corn borer comes up to the plant, tries to eat it, and the toxin kills it. And so Monsanto says, isn't this what you wanted? We've ended pesticides. No more groundwater contamination. No more pollution. This is clean. This is efficient. What are you criticizing us for? What they don't mention is now there's much more toxin being produced than we ever produced with pesticides. With pesticides, it's infrequent and periodic. You start, you stop. With the plant, the gene that codes for the toxins on 24 hours a day. The actual plant is a factory producing chemicals over millions of acres. That's what makes it successful. You're producing so much toxin, you kill most of the insects. You can't kill them all. How long will it take for resistant strains to build up an effective countermeasure? And then what do? Then we're stuck. The biggest problem here is gene flow. When I first introduced this 15 years ago in litigation, the life science company said, Mr. Rifkin, you are such an alarmist. It's so ridiculous. I said, genes will flow. I knew enough about pollination to know genes flow. If you've ever had allergies, you know genes flow in pollen. What happens when the genes for herbicide tolerance and pest resistance flow during pollination? What happens if you are on a conventional farm and you're producing conventional soy and corn for Cargill because Cargill says, we'll give you more for that because Europe won't accept the genetically modified organisms. We'll pay you more for just conventional or organic. You think you're going to grow organic soy, right? Or conventional soy, no genes in it. You take it to Cargill to process for Europe, and what do? They test it, and they find out it's all contaminated. What happened? The neighboring farm was genetically engineered. The pollen just flows over. And to show you how naive or disingenuous Monsanto is, they said, oh, this will never happen. We'll build little refuges around the farm. How does a refuge stop pollen from flowing over to the next farm? But more important from a historic point of view, what happens when weeds, wild relatives, pick up the gene for herbicide tolerance and pest resistance? Corn, we don't have to worry about here. We don't have wild relatives. But a lot of the vegetables, we have wild relatives here for the strawberries and many of the other vegetables. If the wild relatives pick up the gene and they're herbicide tolerant, viral resistant, and pest resistant, and they continue to reproduce over a region, how do we ever get rid of them? It's like introducing exotics into non-native ecosystems. When we take organisms from other parts of the world, we put them in a place where they're never evolutionarily designed for. Many of them fit in. Many of them die out. Some of them become pests. Kudzu vine, Dutch elm disease, chestnut blight, gypsy moth. Can't get rid of them. Here, the scale is what's so incredible. Thousands and thousands of introductions. Most of them will be safe, but the percentages are not with us here because of the scale and the speed of the adaptation of these new genes. We need a moratorium. I've been advocating it for 18 years. When we started with two farmers in opposition. The New York Times said, you'll never, ever get people to say no to this. It's the next great revolution in world history. Now, today, all of Europe has a moratorium. Japan's not accepting it. India is not sure. China thought it was going to, now is having second thoughts. My own prediction will be, this will be one of the great financial miscalculations in the history of modern commerce. It's going to fail. It's going to fail because it doesn't work effectively, and it's going to fail because the consumer's not going to accept it. Let me say one more thing. How many have heard of golden rice? This is a classic example of not looking forward. This is that second generation of crops where they're saying they've now created a strain of rice that has a gene that codes for a protein to create beta carotene. And they're saying this will be great for all the poor kids in the third world who, because they have vitamin A deficiency, they have blindness. So now we put it in the rice. How can Mr. Rifkin be opposed to that? Here's what they don't tell you. Beta carotene isn't vitamin A. All right? So in order for beta carotene to become vitamin A, you have to eat the rice, and then the body has to have enough protein and body fat to be able to translate that beta carotene to vitamin A so it can go through the intestinal walls and be useful. But it's these same babies that don't have the body fat and protein to be able to do that. And there isn't enough beta carotene to make the job happen anyway. It's a hype. It hypes the industry. And lest you think that this case is quite interesting, I had a debate with the head of the Rockefeller Foundation at the World Economic Forum last year, and he's been really pushing this beta-carotene golden rice. I said, tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong. Silence. And then he goes on in the next lecture and just talks about the beta-carotene golden rice. Shameful. 78% of all the people in the world that are malnourished live in countries with food surpluses. Did you hear what I just said? We have the capability of feeding the world. In fact, one of the reasons we're not feeding the world is that in this century, we did something quite unusual in world history. For the first time, we began feeding our animals food grain. We never did that before in history. Today, one-third of all the agricultural land in the world We are using it for feed grain that's then used to feed animals so our wealthy middle-class consumers in America and Europe can eat up high on the food chain at the expense of our fellow creatures and at the expense of our poor brothers and sisters. They're denied food grain for their families in the southern hemisphere so their land can be used to grow feed grain for our animals. And the irony is we die of diseases of affluence from eating all that fatty meat, and our poor brothers and sisters die from malnutrition because they have no access to the land for their food. If someone were to come here from another planet and see the way we've organized all this, they would say, what is the matter with this species? So if we want to deal with food, let's move down the food chain. Let's liberate our fellow creatures so we don't have to continually eat them at their expense. Let's free up the land. Let's grow food for people. Let's have land reform in the third world so that we can have an equitable sharing of God's creation. Dominion, stewardship, as Francis Schaeffer said years ago, stewardship. Why are we here? We're here to do glory to the coming of God's kingdom. That means plant a tree. That means making sure that we steward the planet that we all have to survive under. Okay. I think we should keep a moratorium on this. I should also tell you parenthetically, you know what the insurance industry's read is on all this? I work with the insurance CEOs around the world. They're not covering any of this for insurance liability. Why? Post-asbestos, they don't want to be in the long-range business of insuring against catastrophic losses, especially with global warming. But here they're saying we cannot insure against long-term gene flow for catastrophic environmental losses. Why? They say we have no methodology to judge the risk by. We can't apply premiums. There is no predictive ecology. In chemistry, we have toxicology. You can predict risk. It doesn't work very well, but it gives you some roadmap. There is no predictive ecology because it's so difficult to be able to model what every little gene will do in any given time in any part of the world. It's too complicated. So the insurance industry says no long-term catastrophic insurance coverage. So who's going to cover the losses? The farmers, the consumers, the government? Are we going to need something like the Price-Anderson Act? In the nuclear industry, the taxpayer pays for all the damages if there's a meltdown beyond a certain point of coverage. Do you want to be the coverage of last resort for the life science industry? You willing? How many are willing? Then why are we doing this? Moratorium. If we can't find a way to create a predictive ecology so that we can have some reasonable assurance that there may be some, it'll be safe, why do it? And the health risks are even more interesting. Most of the products will be safe, but we're introducing genes that code for proteins you've never put in your human body. You don't know whether a Chinese hamster gene, when you eat it in that coded product, is going to be safe. There could be allergenic and toxic reaction. The government has long said no, but then we found out in a lawsuit a few years ago when government documents were released that the FDA's own internal documents said there's going to be toxic and allergenic reactions. They never released the documents until the court forced them to. That's the Food and Drug Administration of our government. No genetic foods. I was going to talk about, but this is really depressing. I haven't hit the depressing stuff, so stay with me here. Stay in good mood, because we're not. Do you think there's any reason to believe that this database on biotech could be used to create weapons of destruction? The database we're developing in animal husbandry, in microorganisms, plants, animals, and humans, is completely convertible to designer gene weapons, whose ability to create mass destruction rivals nuclear weapons. And we now know that after September 11th. And every day, we live in Washington. Our mail comes to the central post office where the anthrax hit. My wife has to store up the mail every 2 weeks, and then she goes out with a mask on and gloves as our neighbors to open up the mail because it all comes to the central mail office, and you can't get rid of anthrax spores. I'm not sure they're going to be able to do it at the Hart Building. They live on for a long time. The ability to use this is very interesting because, unlike nuclear, this is a technology that's becoming completely democratized. The materials are totally available. There are thousands and thousands of graduate students who have the capability right now in molecular biology, if they wanted to, and the laboratory equipment freely available, to soup up an organism. What if you wanted to take something like anthrax and soup it up so you had a strain to which there was no antidote? Or what if you wanted to take something like Ebola and put a gene from some other pathogen into it so you create a new organism to which you have no way of responding environmentally? All that's possible by recombining genes. A laboratory would cost you $1,500 to set up in a basement. There are thousands of PhD students now who have the capabilities. You can order the pathogens through the mail from the tissue culture services with a letterhead. You can even ship them in the mail. To me, the most depressing part of the 21st century, if I were your generation at 20, really is designer gene weapons. And now, of course, there's been discussion in recent years about ethnic weapons, because each ethnic and racial group has different genetic predispositions to disease. So once we map the genomes of every ethnic and racial group in the world, what about tailoring a designer weapon so it only affects a particular group, or a particular animal, or a particular plant? We've only begun to take a look at the problems. Genetic discrimination. Genetic discrimination is going to loom as significantly in your century as racial discrimination, religious discrimination, gender discrimination has in years past and centuries past. We're going to be able to provide a genetic profile for everybody here in the next 20 years. You can already do a partial profile. Most of it will come within the next 10 years. Should your employer know your genetic profile? Already, the first company has been sued by the United States government. I think it's Union Pacific Railroad, by the U.S. government, for genetic discrimination of employees on genetic screening. Should your employer know your genetic profile for hiring and promotion? Well, you're going to say no, but maybe we can make a case on the other side. Let's say you have three people on the fast track, top executive position. You're looking to hire one of them. You're the vice president of human resources. Each equally qualified, but one has a genetic predisposition for prostate cancer. The second has a predisposition genetically for breast cancer. The third, no predisposition. All equally qualified. You're going to spend a lot of time training them. Which one are you going to hire? But here's where the discrimination is. Just because you have the genetic predisposition in your profile doesn't mean you're going to get the disease, because it's genotype, phenotype. The gene is not all powerful. Whether it mutates in the protein determines a lot by the environment it's in. Maybe the first two candidates don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't live in pollution, they exercise, they live right, and they don't get the disease. Maybe that third person who has no predisposition is a walking time bomb. Six-pack a day, his notion of exercise is the remote control, he lives in pollution, he's smoking his way through 24-hour days, he gets the disease. You're discriminating based on something that hasn't happened yet, the predisposition. On the other hand, we're hiring for an air traffic controller. Do you want to know if she has a genetic predisposition for bipolar manic depression? On the other hand, she may have it under control with pharmacological intervention, which I'm a believer in, or she may have it under control from therapeutic reasons. It may be that other air traffic controller had a bad day at the house, had a fight with a spouse, lost focus, and that was the problem. We've already conditioned a generation of young people to believe you are your genes. You know, this is a long history of, is it genes, is it nature, is it nurture? We've already, unfortunately, conditioned our children to accept genetic discrimination. We did it in 15 years and no conspiracy. We're going to have to reverse it. Here's what I'm talking about. Between 5% and 20% of all the students in the United States classrooms today in public schools are under medication for genetically predetermined or genetically predispositioned diseases. But between 5% and 20% of any given school, the children are lining up for medication each day. And it's now spreading to the UK, not yet the continent in Europe. Attention deficit disorder is the best example of this. Let me be clear about this. We have 3 million little boys on Ritalin. Some of you have friends or children that are on Ritalin for having a short attention span, for acting out. And we used to say that's hyperactivity. And we used to look at diet and dysfunctional family relations and peer pressure to see what was triggering it. In the 1980s, we simply changed the definition to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and said it's a medically linked, genetically linked disease. And so now we simply put the kid on Ritalin. The problem is this. If it were all just genetically linked, why isn't we aren't seeing little boys, millions of little boys, acting out and acting up in continental Europe, Africa, Asia, and South America? We come from their stock. Could we have mutated in just one generation here? Here's what's likely the case. You know, as parents, children are born with different mood and behavior because they have different genetic predispositions. You have fast kids, slow kids, bucolic kids, crying kids at the get-go. If the child's placed in the first 6 years in an environment, instant gratification, the remote control, the Palm Pilot, the computer and video games, and the stimulation of a 24/7 speed of light society, if that child already has the predisposition genetically, chances are that gene will mutate into that protein by the time they're six and entering first grade. But where do you put your attention? As a parent, your child's suffering, you're suffering, the other kids are suffering, the teacher's definitely suffering. Do you sit there and say we have to reform all of society that's created this kind of hyperspeed world? Or do we use the Ritalin which works? This is the conundrum. This is also the Faustian bargain. It's not just Ritalin. We are treating a whole range of genetic, quote, disorders. But it sends the message to the kid and the parent and the classroom and the community, you're not responsible, you are your genes. That means that child's ready when they're an adult to begin seeing genetic engineering as the way to solve the problems. Instead of reforming society, reform the individual genetic constitution and profile of the people living in the society. Who was the conspiracy? Well, the drug companies like to sell drugs, but basically this just happened. But now that we're aware of it, we're going to have to ask some very tough questions in the classroom about genetic predisposition versus environmental and social triggers, aren't we? Otherwise, we're preparing this generation in this room and your children to accept that it's nature over nurture. I don't have time to do stem cells. I'm going to have to cut right by it, okay? I'm going to keep you a little extra. We can do it at another time. I want to talk about, I should say on genetic discrimination, we need tough legislation. One strike, you're out. I crafted a bill in 1989. It was the first bill introduced in a parliament in the world, in the U.S. Congress. It's 11 years later. We still haven't gotten it passed because the industry, the biotech and insurance industry, doesn't want it passed. We said, look, genetic information is going to flow. It's the nature of the Internet society. But we can sure make sure institutions, whether it's insurance companies or employers or schools, don't use it against your will to abuse you and to have a prejudice against you. But we have to make the punishment tough. One strike, you're out. You lose your corporate charter, long jail sentences as a felony. No one's willing to do that kind of legislation. If we don't do that, we can't nip this in the bud. Your generation's going to have to deal with the question of genetic rights. And genetic rights is going to be as powerful on the political agenda of your generation as human rights and civil rights and gender rights and religious rights have been throughout all of history. Rise to the occasion. Do the right thing. Demand genetic rights. Do not allow institutions to discriminate against you and your children. People make history. Let me talk about one more hard path approach, designer babies. There's now an experimental protocol being reviewed at the National Institute of Health by the scientist, it's Dr. French Anderson, an old, I won't say friend, we've known each other for years. It's the first experiment, if approved, to change the genetic instructions in a fetus. And those changes will probably affect all future generations of that line. You with me? Hasn't been accepted yet. It's the only thing I'm talking about today that hasn't happened yet. All right? We haven't cloned a human, but everything else has happened. So, we're going to be able to provide all of you 18, 19, 20-year-olds, within 5 years, you're going to be able, 10 years at the latest, when you're still in childbearing age, you'll have a pretty good partial profile of you when you walk into the medical office to have a baby. For your children, they'll have the whole profile. Not only the 30 or 40,000 genes, but the 200 or 300,000 proteins they code for. By the way, lest we think that Dawkins and Watson and Crick were right about the powerful gene, we got our upcomings, is that the word, when they came up with the genome, they found out we only have 30,000 genes, maybe 35. Genes not all powerful. And then we were really embarrassed. Turns out the banana has half the same genes, identical genes to the human. This is pretty embarrassing. And now we're saying, oh, it isn't the gene then. It must be the 200 or 300,000 proteins a gene code for. You know what? When they get to the proteins, they're going to find out there's something more, and there's something more, and there's something more. I love it. Keeps us busy, keeps us occupied. So, how many of you, if you had your choice, would be honest and think about this? If you had your choice, you walk into a medical office, you're going to have your whole genetic profile, you'll be able to know, man and woman, what the genetic composition of that child is going to be before you bring together the sperm and the egg. Now remember, you won't know the way the child will turn out environmentally because the genes go against the environment, but you'll know the genetic makeup. How many of you would choose to program parts of your baby for certain reasons in advance? See, none of you have the courage to raise your hands. A couple of you. How many would program some things into your baby if you could? One gene, two, you would. How many would not? Everybody that would not, stand up. I see you. Just stand up. Come on. We're going. Stand up. Everyone that says no. I want you to look at each other, because there's a lot of you in a town where you're going to know each other in 10 years from now. And some of you are going to be married. No, stay up. Stay up. And some of you are going to be married to each other in 10 years from now. Now, I'm going to convince all of you that stood up that you're going to sit down. Am I going to be able to convince you in 2 minutes that you're going to take the program baby? How many think I convince you of that? None of you, right? Okay, sit. I'll convince all of you in 2 minutes. The reason I'm doing this is not to entertain you. It's to really talk about how complicated and sophisticated and layered this is. This isn't an easy black and white. You know, in the past, we were always worried about social eugenics, a Hitler coming along and creating the master race that would rule the world. This new eugenics has come in as a stealth eugenics in the back door. It's benign, it's friendly, it's commercial. Don't you want a healthy kid? You think companies produce this because we don't want it? The companies are producing this because it'll provide some benefit for all of us. And they hope to be there in the markets that are appropriate. This commercial eugenics, though, in the long run, even though we willfully move into it step by step out of volition in the marketplace, it could end up in the brave new world that Aldous Huxley warned us about in 1932 when he wrote the book. Even though our intentions are noble and our mission is just, we could end up in a very dysfunctional world. But it's easy to say no to a Hitler. Now, how easy is it going to be to say no to a program baby? You all said no, right? You get a genetic profile of the two genomes before the sperm and egg come together, and you find out you're going to pass on childhood leukemia. The genetic predisposition is going to be there. Cystic fibrosis. Huntington, chorea. What kind of parents are you? You're going to pass it on. Don't you have a responsibility to your child who has not even yet been conceived to be a responsible parent? Every parent wants the best for their child, usually after birth. In the last 40 years, we've been realizing you have to be responsible for your child during pregnancy. My mother's generation didn't know if you smoked cigarettes that could cause problems. Now, if a woman gives birth to a crack cocaine baby or fetal alcohol syndrome baby, we can prosecute her and put her in jail for child abuse in the womb. Well, why shouldn't it start before? Would you be in favor of that? Prosecuting someone for child abuse in the womb? Well, why not? If somebody is a crack cocaine addict and gave birth, I'm sure a lot of you would say the parents should have been more responsible, right? Why not before birth when you have the genetic profile, a crystal ball of the future? But then where do you draw the line? The ethicists say, oh, there's a slippery slope. We've got to draw the line. There's no line here. What if you knew you were going to pass on the genetic predisposition for a cleft palate? You can get rid of it beforehand, and then you have to deal with a painful surgery later. How about bipolar manic depression and a lifetime of pharmacological intervention which could have impacts on your central nervous system? That's a lot of suffering. What about short stature? You're not going to have a child that's a hypopituitary dwarf, but your little boy, because of your family tree, is going to be 4'11" and suffer the arrows of victimization from society throughout a lifetime. Doesn't every parent want the best for their child physically, emotionally, at the earliest possible stage? Now, how many of you would say you would not do any of this? You would not change any of those genes and just pass it on or not have the baby at all? That's why this is tough. But here's what's really tough here. What's really tough here is the implications. Because once we began to program our children in advance of the conception in the sperm and egg or even in the embryo, it changed forever the relationship between parent and child. The parent becomes the architect, the engineer. The child becomes the ultimate shopping experience in the 21st century. And who owns the technology? Geron has the license for the cloned embryo. Geron in California has the license for stem cells. They're already lining up the reproductive parts of it so they control the market. You buy and you design in advance. What makes cloning so interesting is you know exactly what you're going to get in advance of the execution. That's what no one really picks up here. It's not just, ugh, oh my God, ugh. It's actually being able to design in advance and know in execution what you're going to get before you do it. with designer babies, you up the ante. What if your child doesn't know, like the design you set out for them? Wow, we're going to have some intergenerational conflict here. I didn't want blue eyes. I didn't want to be 5'11". Here's the real difficulty. The real difficulty is, what about the child who isn't genetically engineered in a society where everyone else is? Parents, for religious reasons, decided, or for financial reasons, or for whatever reasons, the child's born the old-fashioned way, the great lottery. The child becomes a gift. Child is born with a disability, old-fashioned childbirth. Now, I put disability in quotes because so much of what we think is a disability, of course, is the way society chooses to treat each other. We all have disabilities then, because we all have deviations from the norm. We all have between 3 and 10 recessive gene traits. We're all disabled then, all right? We're all challenged. On the other hand, let's say this child has a debilitating disability. What are we really going to lose here? Here's the biggest loss, you young people, in your century. We may lose empathy as we move to engineer the perfect baby. This is something the ethicists never talk about. Empathy is the most thin and fragile of all the emotional cords. It's what ties our faith to our sense of our responsibility to ourselves and our fellow creatures. Empathy. When we empathize, do you empathize with perfection? We empathize with someone else, whether it's another creature, fellow traveler, or a fellow human being, because of their frailties, their vulnerabilities, their effort to maintain life, right? But in a world where we come to expect engineering standards and quality controls and predictable outcomes and engineering the baby in advance for all the good reasons, parents, how likely are we to be empathetic to that child who isn't measuring up to the standards we've set? Might we say that child is a defect, a mistake, an error in the code? If we lose empathy, we lose our humanity. It's a big price to pay in order to ensure our health and well-being. This is Faustian bargain right at the extreme. Because I'm going to tell you, I feel there are many of these hard path technologies I would probably want to take. And then I have to say, do I or don't I? This is tough. And so when you leave here today, don't think, oh, this is going to be easy for me. This is going to be hard for all of us. Now, in the last few minutes, I want to say, look, maybe there's another whole way to do it. What if we could find a way to use this science in a way that didn't create these kinds of problems of eugenics? Would that be interesting for all of us? To use the science in a way that would be compatible with our faith, our values, our principles as parents, and our responsibilities for the next generation. There is a soft path approach that hasn't yet been explored. We could take this new science and become a steward and use it in a way that integrates ourselves back into the fabric, the sinew, the fiber of life. I'm going to give you an example from two fields, agriculture and medicine. We could use this science to create a sophisticated, sustainable, organic approach to food. If you had a choice between organic food and genetic food at the same price, what would you choose? First is sustainable, the second not. There is what we call third-generation agriculture. This isn't hypothetical. I've been talking about it for years. I've mentioned it with the company. Some are beginning to do it. It's called third-generation. What we do is we know the genomes of all of our creatures. We're going to be mapping all of our asparagus and our wheat strains, etc. We're going to be able then to have a transparent picture, all of you future geneticists, of every asparagus strain or every wheat strain, so that we can then upgrade classical breeding, because we'll have the transparent picture and knowing which genomes are best crossed, so we can create new clusters within a family. No recombinant DNA, no splicing of genes between unrelated species, work within the family, upgrade classical breeding, but do it more carefully because we actually have a transparent picture of the various strains within the family. So we're doing something that's effective, and then we match those genomes to the environments that they're best suited for. Instead of seeing the environment as the enemy, if it moves, kill it, modern agriculture. If there's an insect, kill it. It's the enemy. No microbes in the soil, no insects. Make it sterile, grow it in oil, nitrogen-based fertilizer, kill it. That's the old Cartesian approach, the Enlightenment approach. Nature's the enemy, we're the sovereign. We create ways to manipulate it so that we can be the masters of our universe. It hasn't worked. Short-term gains, yes. Long-term problems, environment, global warming, groundwater contamination, loss of species, it goes endlessly on. How about medicine? Hard path, genetic drugs, designer babies, And let me tell you something. If my family or myself, if I were really ill, I would take a genetic drug. I don't have a problem with the pharmaceutical products if they're safe. Pharmaceutical products. But that shouldn't be first resort. First resort should be using the science to keep us well. We're using the science hard pass, so if we're sick, we get a magic bullet to make us well. Either change, put a drug in or change your genes after birth or even before conception. What would be the soft path? To use this elegant new understanding of the genes and the proteins they code for to make a market-wise, commercially successful preventive health regime for the Earth. We know that 70% of the diseases that we're going to get in this room have genetic predispositions against environmental triggers, the big ones, the killers, strokes, heart attacks, cancer, diabetes, right? Genetic predisposition, environmental trigger. We also know that changes in diet and lifestyle can affect dramatically whether those predispositions are triggered or not. For example, we know about cigarettes. Don't smoke cigarettes. You're less likely to, your predisposition for cancer is less likely. We're also learning it in other areas now. For example, men, you go to your urologist and you have a history of prostate cancer in your family, your urologist is likely to tell you to eat what? Tomato sauce. What's your name? Ben? Tomato sauce. Because it has a gene that codes for a protein. It's not folk history. It's not folklore. It has a gene that codes for a protein that prevents the mutation. If you have a history of stomach cancer in your family, what is the doctor likely to tell you? What kind of drink should you drink? What kind of tea? Green tea has a gene that codes for the protein. We're just beginning. We're going to map the genomes, the profiles of all the microbes, all the plants. Forget the animals because I think it's time to liberate our fellow creatures. They're powerless in this debate. If you leave here with no other thought today, think about our fellow creatures. We don't need to eat up on the high up in the food chain and completely do a disservice to the rest of the kingdom. We can look at the plants, we can look at the microorganisms and begin to cluster diets for thousands of genes to the actual genetic profile of each person from birth through their passages of life to keep them healthy. And we can do it with lifestyle and recreation and exercise. This is sophisticated science. We could extend the lifespan easily to 100, 95 to 100, without any genetic manipulation whatsoever. Without having to recombine genes or play God or create a eugenic civilization or patent all of this for the sake of a handful of companies. What I'm suggesting is the soft path is more intellectually stimulating. It's more sophisticated because it has to deal with systems and relationships. The hard path's primitive, you geneticists, you young geneticists. It's primitive, it's sophomoric, it's barbaric, it's reductionist. It's not worthy of the intellectual possibilities of your mind. So what I'm saying is leap ahead. Create a new science that's much more elegant and integrative and relational and contextual so that we can have a true legacy here worthy of this generation in the 21st century. Final thing. Does that sound like it makes sense? Final thing. What are the rules of thumb? Look, none of us are clairvoyant. We have to take risks. We're homo faber. We're risk takers. We had to move ahead, and we can't always anticipate all the unanticipated consequences of whatever decisions we make. What are the rules of thumb we ought to use in the 21st century for deciding between hard path, soft path, or some path in between? First, we create a new political spectrum. The industrial spectrum is right-left, still valid because it deals with who owns production, who distributes the fruits, very valid. But a new spectrum is emerging in the age of biology. The intrinsic value of all of life, including our fellow creatures, on one pole, and the pure utility value of all of life on the other. Increasingly, individuals, families, nations will make decisions about which options we want in the age of biology based on where we stand at any given time on that spectrum. Much of it will be in between hard and soft path, utility and intrinsic value. But we need to start with the idea that intrinsic value of life comes first. If you ever met someone who believes utility always comes first, then they have no reference point for what's intrinsic. But many of us who start with intrinsic value can occasionally move toward utility, can't we? Start with intrinsic value. Second rule of thumb, do no harm. Hippocratic oath. If we have options between hard path and soft path and some path in between, take the option that's the least likely to do harm. President Bush was right on stem cells. Instead of working on embryonic stem cells, we can work on adult stem cells, which you can harvest from the body without any problem after birth. The science does not suggest that embryonic stem cells will give us any better results than adult stem cells. Quite the contrary, at least adult stem cells have actually cured a disease. In this case, you may have seen on TV the young child that was cured from sickle cell anemia using the umbilical cord stem cells. Do no harm. Take the adult stem cell instead of the embryonic stem cell. So one, intrinsic value. Two, do no harm. Three, always choose the option that's the most likely to reconnect ourselves as stewards to the rest of the living kingdom rather than to deduct ourselves from the rest of the living kingdom and become isolated as an island. These are rules of thumb. We can do this. Those of you who are 18, 19, and 20, you will live throughout the remainder of most of the 21st century, and your children will be your inheritance into the 22nd century. You will make the decisions. Or if you don't, by a sin of commission, others will make those decisions for you. This is a faith-based community. And this is a community that also believes in ideas and moving the world here at Calvin. You need to begin this debate. It's not enough to have an entertaining one-hour lecture by somebody coming in here. After this is over, you need to set up the study groups. You need to have the seminars. You young people need to become activists on the streets like your fellow brothers and sisters who are opposing genetic foods and opposing cloning and designer babies. There are young people all over the world doing that. Are we doing it here at Calvin? It's not enough to talk the talk. As Bonhoeffer and other theologians after World War II, they talked about the term cheap grace. You know what that is, my friends? Cheap grace is when you go to a Billy Graham rally and afterwards you say, I've been saved. That's it. You don't have to deal with the powers and principalities. You don't have to bear witness to the coming of the kingdom. You don't have to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. You just say, I've been saved. That's cheap grace. Walking the walk means being willing to step out, step forward, be on the front line, be an activist as a parent and as a student and as a member of the Grand Rapids community to make this happen. I truly believe that this new science could be a great leap forward for our children and successive generations. Take the soft path. Make it a legacy. Perhaps we could have a second renaissance. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you Monday in the Fieldhouse, and Mr. Rifkin will be available in the West Lobby for a few minutes to sign books.